England, on the morning of October 14th, 1066. Thousands of Norman soldiers and their allies have invaded the heartlands of the Kingdom of the Anglo-Saxons. The commander of the Norman army, Duke William of Normandy, is seeking a decisive confrontation with the Anglo-Saxon usurper king, Harold Godwinson. After weeks of terrorizing southern England, baiting Harold to battle, Norman scouts now ride into camp with the news that Harold is finally marching south to give battle. The two armies meet 7 miles from the nearest settlement of Hastings. The Norman army has trudged through miles of marshland to reach the foot of a broad grassy slope. At its top, along a low ridge, stands a dense formation of interlocking Anglo-Saxon shields. They greet the enemy with a deafening chorus of taunts and jeers which ring across the valley. With this frightening spectacle at his back, the Duke William harangues his men. He yells at the top of his lungs, beseeching his troops to call forth their warrior spirit. The battle for the future of England is about to begin. You're listening to Time Pulse, and this is the Battle of Hastings. Part 1. Face Off. It's 5 a.m. It's still dark in the Norman camp as men scurry around the campfires, readying themselves for the decisive battle to come. Few of the men have had any real sleep, having been ordered to stand to arms, lest they be attacked in a daring night raid. It's now been almost 3 weeks since the roughly 7,000 strong allied Norman army sailed across the waters from Normandy in northern France to Pevensey on the southeast coast of England. The invasion force, considerable by the standards of the day, has been mustered from multiple regions of France, including Brittany, Flanders, and even Poitou and Aquitaine in the south. But by far the largest component of this force are the Normans. The Normans were descendants of Viking Norsemen who had repeatedly sailed down from the north to raid and pillage the French coast in the 9th and 10th centuries. In order to put an end to these savage attacks, the French king decided to grant land to the Norse warbands in the valley of the Lower Seine. This land would come to be known as Normandy, land of the Northmen. The mantle of leadership of Normandy passed down father to son for generations, until in 1035 it fell somewhat prematurely on the 7-year-old shoulders of William. This sudden transition of power to a young boy made William an enticing target for opportunistic predators, resulting in several kidnapping and assassination attempts. In one such episode, while still a child, an assassin had entered young William's bedchamber and slit the throat of one of his guardians right before his eyes. Sadly, this was not the only of his guardians to meet such a cruel fate. Yet William proved himself to be a capable leader, not only quelling internal rebellions, but also expanding the borders of his domain. He also displayed a discernible ruthless streak, perhaps best illustrated in the small siege of the town of Alençon in Normandy. Purportedly, defenders of the town beat hides on the town's walls, mocking the lowly birth of William's mother, said to be the daughter of a mere tanner. Once he had successfully captured the town, however, William responded mercilessly, although perhaps not unusually for the time, by having the hands and feet of 32 of the town's garrison brutally hacked off. Then, in 1066, at the age of 38, William's chance for real power and glory presented itself with the death of Edward the Confessor, King of England. King Edward had close ties to Normandy and was in fact related to William. Edward was the son of William's great aunt. Edward had also spent a large amount of his life in Normandy, having been exiled there as a child during one of a number of brief spells of Viking rule in England. But this somewhat tenuous blood relation to Edward took a back seat to William's primary claim. That in 1051, as it became evident that Edward would conclude his reign without issue, William had been designated as heir to the throne of England. Or at least, that was William's claim. Whether the story is true or not is fiercely debated by historians to this very day. But either way, in early January, William learned of a gut-wrenching twist. For less than a week after the death of Edward, William would have heard that the crown had been usurped by one Harold Godwinson, Earl of Wessex. Harold Godwinson was the son of Godwin, one of the most powerful earls in all of England during the 11th century. In order to consolidate his position, Godwin had married his daughter Edith to King Edward, thus making Harold and Edward brothers-in-law. But despite these ties, the relationship between King Edward and the Godwin family eventually became strained over time, leading to, amongst other things, the exile of Harold and his brothers at different points of time. But the hodgepodge of events which tie the trio of Edward, Harold, and William together are yet further confused by another somewhat murky incident. According to one mystifying account, some years before the Battle of Hastings, Harold had travelled to Normandy and had been shipwrecked on the coast and taken captive. Apparently, on learning of Harold's capture, William had intervened and had secured Harold's release. At some later point, it is claimed that Harold took an oath of fealty to William, which involved promising to support William's claim to the English throne after the death of Edward the Confessor. The veracity of this episode is hotly debated, with many arguing that later events and political motivations may have influenced the narrative. But nevertheless, if Harold did in fact pledge allegiance to William, then it would lend further context to William's actions in the dramatic events to come. Since arriving on the southern shores of England, the Norman army has been busy laying waste to the nearby countryside and hastily constructing wooden forts. But not every Norman soldier had successfully made it over to England. During the brief yet hazardous crossing, two vessels had become separated from the rest of the fleet in dense fog and had ended up landing 30 miles away. After coming ashore, all those aboard had been butchered by the local inhabitants. But the rest of the Norman army had landed unopposed, and yet Harold the Usurper was nowhere to be seen. But then, 3 days ago, William had finally received word of Harold's movements and the news that Harold had smashed a Viking invasion under Harold Hardrada in the north of England. But even as this news reached William in southern England of the complete annihilation of a Viking army and with it the last of the great Viking warlords, William nevertheless continued on, torching every settlement he encountered, 21 in total, in an attempt to lure Harold Godwinson to battle. He guessed rightly that not only was Harald's army far away to the north, but also that it was severely debilitated from doing battle with such a fierce enemy. But William was also aware of his own vulnerable position. He was abroad in a hostile land with limited supplies, and there was the very real danger of his escape back to Normandy being cut off by the Anglo-Saxon fleet. And so, for these reasons, William was eager to give battle. There was, however, no knowing what Harald would do next and how the invasion as a whole was going to play out. At least, that was the story until yesterday, when Norman scouts had entered the camp during daylight, informing William that miraculously, Harald had yet again lightning marched his army back down the length of England, bolstering his battle-weary force with replacements along the way. Harald, it seemed, would answer William's call to battle. It is now 6:15 in the morning. The first signs of a new day are now visible in the sky, now a faint bluish hue. The camp is a hive of activity. Before long, hundreds of wagons carrying armor, weapons, and other equipment for battle begin to move off. By 7 a.m., the sky is lit up by a bright blood-orange light, no doubt foreshadowing what is to come. The army has now been marching for an hour. All the while, scouts have been riding in from the north, updating Duke William with the movements of the enemy. The wagons creak and groan under the weight as teams of oxen plod up and over ridges. The men quietly march alongside as their pulse begins to quicken and battle is just hours away. And then, as the army reaches the crest of a hill known as Heshland, William orders a halt. The call goes out to prepare for battle. Bags of armor and weaponry are being thrown from the wagons as men begin to dress for the fight. The soldiers, already in their padded leather jerkins, now struggle their way into knee-length mail hauberks, each of which is made up of a series of hundreds of small interlinked iron rings. They tighten the layers together with a leather belt, from which those lucky enough hang their most prized war instruments, their lethal, double-edged, slashing swords. After putting up their hoods, they don the iconic helmet of the age, with its nasal guard to protect from blows to the face. Finally, they reach for their kite shields, named as such for their rounded top, which tapers to a point at the bottom to protect the soldiers' legs. But this army is far from being armed and clad uniformly. Rather, there is an eclectic mix of assemblages. Most of the men are carrying spears, both for throwing and thrusting. A few of the men are having to forgo any armor whatsoever, and instead must rely on the padding from their leather jerkins alone. Soon, there's movement again. The army marches on, snaking its way north over streams, between trees and up and over gentle ridges. And then suddenly, news begins to filter down the line that the enemy has been spotted occupying a prominent ridgeline and barring the way north. There's a sudden and noticeable surge in energy amongst the men. Moments later, the army rounds a forested headland and are greeted by a formidable spectacle. The entire Anglo-Saxon army, bristling with spears, swords, and axes, are formed up along the ridge line. But before the Norman army can take up their positions, They have to wade through ever-thickening mud. Though it hasn't rained, the headwaters of two small streams to either side of them has made the ground marshy and has now been stamped, squelched and churned into thick mud by the passage of men and horses. The narrowing of the army, as it squeezes between these two small bodies of water, creates a momentary advantage for the Anglo-Saxons and a potential crisis point for the Normans. As they stagger through the mud, the men fear that the wall of lethal metal above them will suddenly burst forth in a terrifying charge. But in the end, their passage into the valley goes unmolested. The enemy stays put, their ranks closed up, content to wait for the battle to be brought to them. With the potential crisis having passed, the Norman army begins to take up its positions for battle. They now stand at the foot of a 400 to 500 meter long slope leading up to a ridge known as Senlac Hill. The ridge is flanked by forest, streams and marshland, making anything other than a frontal assault up the hill and into the front lines unfeasible. But nevertheless, despite the obstacles, this hill stands in fact just 84 meters tall. Nor is it spacious. The ridge is just 800 meters long and 150 meters deep, meaning that the 7,000 men occupying it are closely pressed together. But this tight squeeze means that the defensive line is welded shut, shield overlapping shield. The men are lined up in rows, just 10 to 12 ranks deep. The first 2 to 3 ranks of roughly 800 men are composed of Harald's elite household troops, the famed housecarls, many of whom have come all the way down from the distant north of England, bruised and battered after a brutal combat with the Vikings. Behind the housecarls stand the Ferd, the Anglo-Saxon military levy, which performed military duties as one of a number of services in return for the land they held on behalf of the king. The Ferdmen fighting on this day, however, are unlikely to be the same men who had fought the Viking army in the north. Thus, these men were not only less well armed than their fierce housecarl companions, but they were also lacking that essential battle experience that would prove pivotal in the battle to come. Also lacking on the Anglo-Saxon side was any noticeable sign of a cavalry contingent. Instead, it was common for high-ranking men to dismount before battle. Nor was there a sizable presence of archers to snipe away at the Norman soldiers and horsemen. Therefore, it was the professional housecarl troops that would be relied upon to do most of the work this day. Over the heads of the Anglo-Saxons flutter a sea of war banners. Standing above the rest are two particularly tall and impressive ones. One, the Dragon of Wessex, was a windsock that, once filled with air, formed into a hollow red winged dragon. The second was the Fighting Man, a heroic warrior figure holding a sword and shield. These two iconic banners mark Harald's location along the center of the Anglo-Saxon line. Other clusters of banners to the left and right suggest the presence of other notable figures, including Harald's brothers, Gyrth and Leofwin. The Norman soldiers stare up at their adversaries from the foot of the hill. They are a 3,500 strong force of heavily armored Norman infantry and cavalry. This is the core of William's army. On the Norman's right flank was positioned Roger de Montgomery, along with roughly 1,500 mercenaries and allied troops from Flanders and northern France. On the left flank was positioned another of the Duke's allies, Count Alan the Red of Brittany, leading 2,000 Bretons, Poitevins, Angevins, and men from the county of Maine. The lines of the two armies were drawn up east to west. The slope on the eastern side of the battlefield, that which was occupied by the Normans' right flank, was noticeably steeper than on its western side. But this gentler slope, on which was positioned the Norman left flank, was interrupted by a small hillock. Water had collected between the slope and this hillock, making for yet another marshy area on the battlefield. It is on this hillock that a desperate episode of the battle would play out. Suddenly, cheers and shouts ring out as William the Duke of Normandy and his captains lead the rearguard into the valley. William lifts his arm in acknowledgement and rides into position in the rear. The Duke's men carry with them two banners. One, the Raven Banner, was the emblem of Odin. This was a Viking flag of the kind also ridden into battle by the recently slain Viking leader, Harald Hardrada. It is an emblem that reifies the Normans' Norse origins. The other was a white banner with a golden cross, the Papal Banner. This banner signified the support and blessing from the Pope in Rome, and the Duke's men would have regarded it with an overwhelming sense of awe. Roger de Montgomery and Count Alan the Red of Brittany ride over to Duke William in the rear. They are joined by the Duke's Norman companions, William Fitzosborne and Eustace of Boulogne, along with the Duke's other half-brother, the warrior and ordained Christian clerk, Odo of Bayeux. Together, now dismounted, these men strategize over the battle to come. Meanwhile, in the body of the army, lieutenants busily mobilize the men and horses, screaming orders. At the same time, priests and servant boys ply the lines, giving blessings to soldiers who kneel before them. All the while, a rising tide of insults and jibes are hurled across the valley between the two armies. The energy builds to a fevered pitch. Next time on Time Pulse, we'll see if the Normans and their allies, with their mixed array of battle tactics, can break the formidable shield wall of the Anglo-Saxons. We'll see if Harald's elite housecarls and their body-crunching two-handed axes can fend off the attackers for long enough to ensure victory. And we'll see if Duke William has the mettle to withstand the greatest crisis in the battle as huge swathes of his army disintegrate. And as a rumor rolls through the ranks like a shockwave, that he, the Duke, has fallen. All this and more to come next time on Time Pulse.